held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Google Voice will try
when
to connect you.
When you attend a funeral, it is sad to think that sooner or later those you love will do the same for you. And you may have thought it tragic, not to mention other adjectives.
Hello?
To think of all the weeping they will do.
Michelle?
Mitchell?
And don't you worry. No more ashes, no more sackcloth.
Hello?
And an armband made
hey,
of black
we're here.
We'll someday nevermore adorn
hello?
A sleeve. For if
hello?
The bomb that drops
Michelle,
on you
Michelle, just stand by.
Gets your friends
oh, okay, very good.
And neighbors too, there'll be nobody left behind to grieve, and we will all go together when we go. What a comforting fact that is to know. Universal bereavement, an inspiring achievement. Yes, we all will go together when we go. We will all go together when we go, all suffused with an incandescent glow. No one will have the endurance to collect on his insurance. Lloyd's of London will be loaded when they go. We will all fry together when we fry. We'll be French fried potatoes by and by. There will be no more misery when the world is our rotisserie. Yes, we all will fry together when we fry. We will all bake together when we bake. There'll be nobody present at the wake. With complete participation in that grand incineration, nearly 3 billion hunks of well-done steak. We will all char together when we char. And let there be no moaning of the bar. Just sing out a te deum when you see that ICBM, and the party will be come as you are.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Raw Deal. Before I introduce my featured guest for today, I want to report several developments in the area of the scamdemic. A group of scientists and doctors has issued an open letter calling on the European Medical Agency, EMA, to answer urgent questions regarding the safety of COVID vaccines or withdraw the vaccine's authorization. The letter describes serious potential consequences, warning of possible autoimmune reactions, blood clotting abnormalities, stroke, and internal bleeding, including in the brain, spinal cord, and heart. The authors request evidence that each medical danger outline was excluded in preclinical animal models with all three vaccines prior to their approval for use in humans by the EMA. Should all such evidence not be available, the authors write, we demand the approval for use of gene-based vaccines be withdrawn until all the above issues have been properly addressed by the exercise of due diligence by the EMA. Very important. Meanwhile, it turns out that back in 2001, the U.S. Department of Justice legalized non-consensual human experiments, and the Department of Defense waived informed consent. This was a violation of the Nuremberg Code, the Geneva Conventions, and U.S. law. The Pentagon sought to lift the prohibitions on research involving prisoners, where Department of Justice attorneys sought to craft a piece to waive informed consent for human experimental subjects, a direct contradiction of presidential and DOD policy memos of the 1990s prohibiting waivers of informed consent related to classified research. I expect this to become an important issue here with all the efforts by the Biden administration to promote the vaccines, and where the speech by this imposter Biden last night was really on the order of a commercial for Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson. It was embarrassingly bad and didn't deal with all the serious issues and ramifications related thereto. There are also multiple visual indications it was pre-recorded so he wouldn't commit any gaffes. Meanwhile, Stats Canada claims the lockdowns, not COVID-19, are driving excess deaths. Canada's National Statistical Agency stated in a report released yesterday that there are excess deaths in the country compared to previous years, but that those deaths are not due only to COVID-19, but due increasingly to what it calls indirect consequences of the pandemic, citing as examples delayed medical procedures due to lockdown and increased substance use. We also have a Stanford medical professor, lockdowns, worst public health mistake of the last 100 years. I have no doubt about it. The professor warned lockdowns are disproportionately impacting the poor and making wealth inequality worse, explained that areas that imposed the most draconian lockdowns didn't see the most success in controlling the virus. I stand behind my comment that the lockdowns are the single worst public health mistake in the last 100 years. We were counting on catastrophic health and psychological harms imposed on nearly every poor person on the face of the earth for a generation. All this, in my opinion, is highly encouraging since in different nations around the world, more and more experts are speaking out in opposition to the manufactured pandemic, the consequences of which are going to be endure for generations, as the professor observed. I'm very pleased to have as my featured guest today a woman with a great breadth of experience, including personal, Michelle Stefanik, who's got a lot of information to share with us. Michelle, welcome to the Raw Deal.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you. Now, I preface this. This is my first interview, but I do have some starting comments just to put in context, if you don't mind.
Please.
Okay. So why is my situation, my story important? Because I have no doubt you will agree, because this is one long, big continuum. I want to begin with this. The truth matters. And for this constitutional oath taker, and I have no doubt I can speak on you, your behalf as well, the American people matter. I'm not a researcher. I'm a firsthand victim and witness that had federal Crime Victim Rights Act protected status. And regardless, I was massively retaliated against. And most importantly, I didn't ask for any of this. But here I am. So needless to say, I do have a fire hose full of facts, timelines, comments, insights. But first of all, I want to focus in on two most important concepts. One, the oath to defend the Constitution. That's not an oath to defend a person, a president, a party. It's defend the Constitution against all enemies, not just foreign, but domestic. And there are three equal branches of government in our Constitution. The deep state, corrupt in all three, of which I have direct linkage, firsthand experience regarding all three. But I want to really focus in on this. As Speaker Pelosi has said over and over again herself, no one is above the law. So in my case, what law is applicable? Well, enacted in 2004, the Crime Victims' Rights Act gives victims of criminal offenses in federal court certain rights and proceedings. But furthermore, officers and employees of the U.S. Department of Justice and other departments and agencies of the United States engaged in detection, investigation, or prosecution of crime shall make their best efforts to see that crime victims, such as myself, are notified and, furthermore, accorded the rights described. According to the Department of Justice Victim Witness Handbook itself, it says, victims and witnesses have the right to be free of harassment or intimidation by the defendants and others, highlighting that it is a federal offense to threaten, intimidate, harass, or mislead a witness in a criminal or civil proceeding. So, Jim, let's start off with a rhetorical question such as this. What happens when the same individuals that wrote that law are a part of those that violated the law, that law?
Yeah, that's a great question, Michelle. You might want to give a thumbnail sketch of how you happened to be in this situation and what has happened to you for our audience to appreciate where you're coming from.
Okay. Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to provide a thumbnail what I initially thought this was about. Because as the events unfolded, more and more people contacted me to realize, I say, give me breadcrumbs, to realize that I was a key of a much bigger dynamic that I had no idea. So let me start with this. Do you remember on August 7, 1998, we had a horrific attack of two embassies in Africa, East Africa, Kenya and Tanzania? I was assigned to Embassy Nairobi on excursion tour from the State Department's Office of Inspector General as the Financial Management Center Director at that time. I physically was in Ethiopia that day and returned to the embassy the aftermath of the bombing the next day. My section took the biggest hit. It took the brunt of the explosion. My section was the financial section. I lost half my staff that day. I was scheduled to depart on August 20th, of just weeks after that, and I did. April, May of 2000, I was studying for Russian language at our Foreign Service Institute when an AUSA from the Department of Justice, Southern District of New York, came down to visit me, to talk to me about my opinion on some matters that they were pursuing in regards to the trial that was later held in Department of Justice, Southern District of New York, New York City. Based on our discussion, I received, and it's documented, a May 8th, 2000, an immediate release from the U.S. attorney at the time, Mary Jo White, and the FBI director at the time in Southern District of New York, Barry Mon. Only weeks after I had spoken to the AUSA. And in this indictment count, one of the components says this: the superseding indictment also contains additional counts relating to the murder of employees of the U.S. Department or the U.S. United States government, including Kenyan and Tanzanian citizens who worked at the American embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam, as well as diplomats protected by international treaties. The indictment also contains additional overt acts not previously specified. The trial for this case has been set for September 5th, 2000. Jim, before my discussion with the AUSA that came down to see me at the U.S. State Department Foreign Service Institute, as of March, April 2000, timelines matter, so I put that date out, my Kenyan staff were not included in the charges. And that's the relevance as to the superseding document. Now, again, the timing is very important because that had gone into the next administration. As is clearly documented, the embassy bombing happened under President Bill Clinton. Secretary of State at that time was Madeleine Albright. The Assistant Secretary for African Affairs at that time was Susan Rice. Jim, why did it take me to have a discussion with the AUSA, which he said at that time, when I said, do not treat us the way the State Department has treated us, why have you not included my staff that was killed? And you know what this AUSA said to me? He goes, Michelle, do you realize you are the first one to bring this matter up to us, and we are this far down the line that we're talking to you about whether you agree with capital punishment or not, because that's the kind of sentencing they were going to be requesting. So fast forward, as you may remember, on May 1, 2011, Bin Laden was, and I put these in quotes, captured and killed. I was assigned with the U.S. military in Stuttgart, Germany. On May 30th, 2011, the Accountability Review Board Accountable Regional Security Officer sent me an email. And now you have to understand, with my State Department OIG auditing background, professional auditor background, and her law enforcement background, that email she sent to me was the very first time she implied that our embassy bombing was an inside job. Now, let's go back. I was assigned to Embassy Moscow, and I was flown back by the Department of Justice, Southern District of New York, to attend the sentencing portion of the embassy bombing trial that was held in June of 2001. Do you understand the timelines?
Yes, yes.
Do you know where we stayed?
Tell us.
The World Trade Center Marriott.
Fascinating.
Okay, so events happened that after Stuttgart, I can go into a lot of detail, but as you can see, it is just unbelievable, the timeline of events. I was at the Pentagon, assigned with the Office of Secretary of Defense, and all of a sudden, September 12, 2012, the diplomatic post Benghazi attack occurred. Jim, I not only had my aha moment, I had my ahem moment, realizing, oh my God, I know exactly what this is about. Connecting the dots, I requested that I have my protected status and that I go up and talk accordingly with the Southern District of New York. Instead of being protected, I was massively retaliated against, even more so than I had been at the hands of the military after Bin Laden's kill and capture. I put that in quotes because, well, everything's now questionable. I was retaliated against during and under the tenure of President Barack Obama, Vice President Biden, Secretary Clinton, Susan Rice, Secretary Kerry. Now, how many of these people were senators at the time of the embassy bombings? How many of these individuals knew firsthand my direct correlation with being a victim and witness in regards to the embassy bombings? How many of these individuals were senators that actually enacted the Crime Victims' Rights Act protected status and law in which I had protections and accorded protections? But that didn't matter. I was massively retaliated against to the point that I filed pro se U.S. Supreme Court case filings in August of 2016. It's documented, it's there, and I did it pro se because I knew what this was all about, and I knew I was telling the truth, and I wanted all this to end. So again, facts and timelines matter. Jim, my filings with the U.S. Supreme Court case, which was number 16-223, was initially filed Tuesday, August 16, 2016. Jim, prior to the Clinton-Trump presidential election. In my Supreme Court case filings, and you'll appreciate this, I was aware of two data points. One, because of folks like you and others, I became more and more aware, attuned as to 9/11 and the Pentagon, because I was overseas. I was in Moscow when 9/11 happened. I was unaware until the retaliatory actions were taken against me of Secretary of Defense's Donald Rumsfeld's statement on September 10 regarding the $2.3 trillion. At that point in time, I also had awareness of Susan Lindauer's statement of December 27, 2014 regarding the over $14.6 trillion of missing CIA black operational money that had been discovered to be diverted in the mid-1990 timeframes. Our embassy bombings happened on August 1998. Jim, I was a part of the State Department's Office of Inspector General audit team that initially discovered, though it was not under the scope of our audit, funds being diverted. It was outside of our scope, so when we came back, we had to do an investigative referral or an audit follow-up. I did not know at all the magnitude of the amount of money that we found that was diverted until Susan Lindauer's statement on December 27, 2014. I had no idea, as I'm sure the members of my team had no idea, that it was black CIA operational money. Because I stand by what I know, because, of course, when you're working on a federal audit, that's considered a protected activity. Without going to extensive detail, Jim, I had two data points to include in my Supreme Court case filings. The September 10, 2001 statement by Secretary of Defense of the $2.3 trillion, or the Susan Lindauer statement of the over $14.6 trillion. I have referenced in my Supreme Court case filing, because I know what this is about, the over $14.6 trillion of diverted CIA black operational money. Now, my question is, did Secretary of Defense know that it was $2.3 trillion of $14.6 trillion? Because if he would have made that statement on September 10, if he would have said the $14.6 trillion amount, the bigger amount, everybody would have known instantly there is no way that could have been done other than internal U.S. government, correct?
Absolutely.
On November 27, 2012, I wrote an 8-page handwritten on legal paper whistleblower protection request letter. I gave it to, now this name's going to sound familiar, the Director General at the time of the State Department, Linda Thomas Greenfield. Linda Thomas Greenfield had served with me in Kenya, but had departed before the bombings. In 2012, when I connected the dots, I gave her the first copy of my handwritten whistleblower protection request letter. In that letter, I clearly stated, because I knew what this was all about and because I knew I had protected activity status because of how I knew the information, I asked to be protected, but I also asked that I would share accordingly everything that I knew and everything that I know, but only with someone that I trusted. She did absolutely nothing and then later participated in the retaliatory actions taken against me. That being said, because I had done a congressional fellowship up on the Hill with an APSA congressional fellowship with Senator Olympia Snowe after I had returned from my 2003 to 2005 tour in Sudan, I then went up and did an APSA congressional fellowship with Senator Olympia Snowe from 2005 to 2006. I went up on November 28, 2012, and gave another handwritten copied letter to Senator Olympia Snowe. I went to her office. She was not expecting me. I had to wait in her waiting room until she could squeeze me in because she had a very, very tight schedule as she had just announced that she was retiring from the Senate. I had worked with her chief of staff. I said that I would wait until, you know, even to the end of the day to meet with her. She, after meeting with me only 5 minutes, she saw the extremity to what I was trying, I knew. She did the best thing she could in her position. She gave a copy of my letter. She contacted immediately the Office of Inspector General from the intelligence community. She contacted James Clapper, ODNI. She gave a copy to the Department of Justice
McCabe. Hold that thought. We're about to hit the break. This is absolutely fascinating. It's marvelous to have such a stunning intellect as yours blowing the whistle on these inside developments in the U.S. Department of State. We'll be right back with Michelle Stefanik.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Jim.
Mute Michelle.
Hello?
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Thank you, Jim.
Management would like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Hey, everyone. It's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, this is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Raw Deal. As everyone is discerning, I have as my featured guest today a longtime Department of State official who is blowing the whistle on shenanigans, not only in the administration of Bill Clinton involving but also that of Barack Obama involving figures like Susan Rice and Hillary Clinton and John Kerry. And Michelle, it's just fascinating to hear such a formidable intellect as yours doing such a surgical dissection of what was taking place and blowing the whistle so loudly and so clearly.
Thank you, Jim. But like I said, I didn't ask for any of this. But if you don't mind, I'm going to give a little bit more context. Now, on September 30th, 2013, because you have to understand, Jim, I'm very passionate still. I'm very raw as to what happened to me. And so if it gets too detailed, I don't know if I can go through the whole entire interview. You know what I'm saying? So, but I want to give you some more high tops. On September 30th, 2013, due to the retaliatory actions that were taken against me, I submitted my resignation letter to Secretary of State John Kerry. On September 16, 2013, I was notified by Secretary Kerry that he accepted my resignation effective October 1, 2013, as I requested. I was off the payroll. I was making plans to move forward. Because my thought is I would not step forth another foot in the Department of State now knowing what I knew. However, within weeks, despite being removed from the U.S. Department of State payroll, I was subjected to yet another round of retaliation to include being deemed incapacitated. They brought me back onto state payroll only to deem me incapacitated. Now, remember I told you that I was getting breadcrumbs along the way? I actually started in the government in 1987 with Defense Contract Audit Agency. The reason why that is pertinent is because, and as you may recall, Lockerbie happened in 1988. My last audit with Defense Contract Audit Agency, before I transitioned to the State Department's Office of Inspector General, resulted in me doing an audit referral, investigative referral, with DCIS, Defense Criminal Investigative Service. It was of a major defense contractor, and you'll get this, in the Tysons Corner, McLean area. As I left DCAA and had started State Department in 1988, I never got contacted regarding the status of the investigation. But as you may or may not recall, do you know what happened in 1988?
Refresh my memory.
Lockerbie.
Yes. Blamed on Gaddafi, falsely, undoubtedly.
Right, and that then ties into Benghazi 2012, doesn't it? But it's also, Robert Mueller was involved in that. Well, during the course of what was happening to me in 2013, after I had my aha moment, a breadcrumb was given to me. And that's why I realized this also went back even further from my State Department days back to my DOD DCAA days. Because at that point in time, I was also asked if I was aware that on that flight, not only were the two whistleblowers, I'm sure you know the one captain, I think he was Special Forces DIA, and the other, the deputy chief of station from Lebanon, that supposedly were coming back on that flight with the suitcase of heroin to do whatever, you know, the theory is that they were going to come back and confront the CIA and drug cartel connections. But what I was made aware of into 2013, 2014, by a Department of Justice official, I was asked if I was aware that also on that flight were supposedly many Department of Justice, U.S. attorneys, as well as FBI agents accompanying those two individuals back. I had never been aware of that. I was never made aware of that until 2012-2014 timeframe. So that's when I realized, oh my gosh, this goes back to when I was with DCAA. Jim, that then brings it into context of also, that was during Reagan and George H.W. Bush. So this is not a party issue. This is Americans that are doing things that are really improper. And I would offer up to the level of, you know, high treason as well as murder. And as you are well aware, there's no statute of limitation on murder. There's no statute of limitation on treason. So then I started getting more and more information to the point of, oh my goodness, the World Trade Center in 1993, was that also a false flag? Was USS Cole a false flag? Because as you may or may not be aware, the lead FBI investigator for USS Cole was FBI agent John O'Neill, who was later, when he resigned from the FBI, was the top security guy for the World Trade Center.
And died on his World Trade Center. And died on his first day on the job on 9/11.
So as you can see, this is one huge, long continuum. Now, also very interestingly enough, though I didn't think of anything of it at the time I was like living my life, I had a lot of circumstances of connecting to John F. Kennedy via meeting Ted Sorensen's sister, Ruth Singer, when I did my first excursion tour from the Office of Inspector General at Embassy Nairobi or Embassy Yaoundé, Cameroon, from 93 to 95. Because of meeting Ruth Singer, I then later got introduced to her brother, Ted Sorensen. When I was with Senator Olympia Snowe doing an APSA Congressional Fellowship, Ambassador Mary Ryan, passed away very suddenly, and one of my fellow APSA Congressional Fellows was working for Senator Ted Kennedy. That individual told me that Senator Kennedy wanted to write a congressional record statement in tribute to Ambassador Mary Ryan and her passing, and I gave some firsthand comments for them to include. So these are all documented. This isn't, you know, this is documented. You go to the congressional record, Senator Ted Kennedy, tribute to Ambassador Mary Ryan. I helped draft that, as well as Senator Olympia Snowe let me put in a draft for her consideration regards to the memory of commemoration of our embassy bombings anniversary. So when Susan Lindauer had Christopher Fulton on her show, I immediately, because you have to understand, I realize you have done extensive background investigation on the JFK assassination to basically prove that your fellow Marine did not do it. And I would offer to you, as you may or may not be aware, a Marine security guard died in our embassy bombings in Kenya. So when I heard about Christopher Fulton's book, since I had this, I wasn't even born when John F. Kennedy was assassinated, but since I had this recent connection with Ted Kennedy, as well as Ted Sorensen, I said, well, I'm going to read Christopher's book. This is very fascinating. Until then, I read the book and realized the timeline of events of correlating with what happened to him happened and what happened to me, the overlap of our two storylines. Because, again, I was overseas when 9/11 happened. I am aware, recently I made aware of the Army accounting section, and I would offer to you, how is it possible that Rumsfeld says on September 10 that $2.3 trillion is missing, and the next day the exact location where the money was missing was destroyed? You've been in the Pentagon. I've been in the Pentagon. That doesn't happen by coincidence. That being said, my section was the financial section. Oh, and back to that May 30, 2011 email that the accountable RSO sent to me after bin Laden's capture and kill that may or may never have happened. That's the first time that I was asked by this RSO, was I aware that our embassy in Nairobi was a huge major CIA hub? She was beyond fit to be tied. I said no. I was not aware either, and I was from the State Department's Office of Inspector General, but I was not made aware of that until May 30th, 2011. So when I talked to Christopher and I saw the correlation, there's a lot of correlations, and that's why I'm of the opinion this is one huge long continuum. This is a battle in the dark. That dark world within our own U.S. government that has to stop and has to stop now. First of all, in order for it to stop, people have to acknowledge that's what was or is going on.
Oh, absolutely, Michelle. And by the way, if it's agreeable to you, we'll take callers a second hour. I'm sure there are lots of questions our audience would like to pose to you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, Jim, again, I want to qualify when I do this is there are things that I, being firsthand, that I can, I know firsthand. There are opinions and comments and insights that I have to current events, to things that are playing out. And I also just want to preference the two, because as you know, there's a big difference between being a firsthand victim and witness that I can sign an affidavit to on events, and those based on information that I know, particularly under protected activity, that why I'm of the opinion that I'm of, that I cannot disclose all that I know. Does that make sense?
Sure, of course. Absolutely, 100%.
That being said, I also then heard about Scott Bennett's situation as well. And I have a lot of comments in regards to his connection to this and what was really going on with him. But so that's basically, oh, there are a couple of things that I just want to toss out there. The question has never been answered. Not that Hillary Clinton and the U.S. Secret Service established the Secret Service at the State Department, but why did Hillary Clinton and the U.S. Secret Service deem it necessary to have a separate Secret Server while she was at the State Department? And was there prior approval knowledge by President Obama and Vice President Biden? Or did she do it on her own? That question needs to be asked, is more pertinent than even the emails that have been scrubbed. Why did she even feel it necessary to begin with? And my question is also this. If bin Laden and Al-Qaeda was behind the August 7, 1998 East Africa Embassy bombings, which, by the way, they were not, then why was I, a single female, such a threat to the entire U.S. government, U.S. military, U.S. intelligence, and U.S. law enforcement community? Because, Jim, this dealt with the money, the diverted money.
Yes, 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 and I see where there's an overlap in the kinds of exposés you're in a position to present with those that Scott Bennett's been in a position to present on shell games and a shell game, and where, you know, taking out the committee, the group that was the section that was looking into the missing $2.3 trillion in the West Wing, which was the only wing of the Pentagon that had been remodeled and reinforced so that it was largely bereft of personnel and records, except for the section chiefs whom Rumsfeld had directed to go there with all their documents and records to track the 2.3 trill so that they could be taken out during the attack on 9/11. I mean, Michelle, it's just disgusting. I'm fascinated to know, by the way, how much speculation, if any, there was at the time that 9/11 was an inside job rather than 19 Islamic terrorists who had neither the background nor the ability nor actually even the motivation to undertake those events. Your thoughts?
First of all, I want to offer this insight as well, because I know you have this information as well. In addition to the Army Accounting Section, Naval Intelligence was also hit that day, correct?
Yeah.
Supposedly all the files for the JFK assassination were destroyed that day.
Oh, that's new. That is news to me, Michelle. They were there because the Navy had them?
That's my understanding. Well, John F. Kennedy was Naval Intelligence.
Of course. Well, he was Navy. I was unaware of Navy intelligence. Tell me more, Michelle. Fascinating.
That's my understanding of listening to shows such as yours, because like I said, I was overseas when 9/11 happened. I was in Moscow. Now, I would offer to you, talking about 9/11, how is it that President Putin was the very first one to call President Bush and say that he is you know, given his sympathies, but also given his arm, just, you know, hand of saying that they would do anything to help to get to the truth. Now, this is speculation on my part, but I just toss this out there. At the time, you also hear the Mir space station. That's a joint space station. Americans are also in that space station at that time. So did they have information that they wanted to share and pass directly to President Bush and tried and attempted and was unable to until Putin met with President Trump?
Well, they've done everything they can to cover it up. I mean, it's evident in retrospect, the reason for the theft of the election in 2000 was to get Bush and Cheney in to bring us 9/11 to benefit Israel by creating a pseudo pretext for getting American forces into the Middle East to take out the modern Arab states that served as a counterbalance to Israel's domination of the entire region and eventually to confront the Persian nation of Iran. And it appears to me now with this feeble Biden administration that they're trying to manipulate the situation to finish the job, in particular with Iran, since it has become apparent to me the reason they went all in against Trump, suppressing information negative to Biden was because Trump was not willing to bomb Iran, and they felt Biden would be.
As I said, this is one long continuum, isn't it?
100%. And, you know, you were dealing with some of the more corrupt individuals in the American government of recent times. Donald Rumsfeld, for example, where he and Dick Cheney and Karl Rove appear to have been the triumvirate that decided to take out Paul Wellstone when he was going to speak out against the invasion of Iraq, where Cheney personally warned him that if he opposed them on Iraq, that there would be severe ramifications for him personally and for the state of Minnesota. We're taking out the senator, his wife, his daughter, three of his aides, and the two pilots was most certainly of that caliber.
Now, I have two also theories that I have been developing based on my insight and my connections and my putting two and two together. One is this. I know this is going to be a big controversial statement, but it has to be stated. And like I said, you have done a wonderful job in clearing your fellow Marine that he, Oswald, did not assassinate the President, John F. Kennedy. Jim, and I just tossed it out there, and I know this may be unfair, but I tossed this out there. Why did Jackie keep her bloody pink Chanel suit on? I know a lot of people say because she wanted everybody to see what they did to her husband. I would offer to you it was to maintain chain of custody so that nobody could take the Chanel suit away from her so that they could test the blood, especially since the casket information is now coming out. I would offer that there's also a possibility that John F. Kennedy knew that there was a threat and he wanted to prove that there was a conspiracy and that maybe a body double was actually killed that day, not John F. Kennedy. I think they knew that Robert Kennedy was aware of this, but they never suspected that Jackie was involved or Jackie knew. Now, whether you agree or not with Christopher Fulton's book, I do agree with some portions of it, and I have been in discussions with Christopher. Now, you remember the email that Susan Rice supposedly wrote on January 20th, 2017, to the file after Trump was brought into office? And she kept referencing... But she kept referencing the phrase, buy the book, buy the book, buy the book. Yeah. Why would the FBI and the Department of Justice have to be informed to go buy the book? I would offer to you that is actually not BY the book, it's BUY the book. And the book that she's talking about and referencing is Christopher Fulton's book, because on page 114 of Christopher's book, it, for the first time that I was aware, openly discloses the President Eisenhower's top secret agreement with and regarding the CIA and it operating above the law. Because the timing of Christopher's book being published, it would have been in draft at that time. So that's why I'm saying, I'm not saying all these are facts. I'm just saying when you timeline facts and events, there's a lot of overlap, and there is the diverted story, and then there's the real story.
Well, Michelle, I'm fascinated by what you're presenting here today, as I'm sure our audience is completely absorbed. Your suggestion about Jackie retaining the clothing for the purpose of possible testing of the blood is intriguing, but I can guarantee you with 100% confidence, JFK had his brains blown out in Dealey Plaza. The idea of a body double can arise because they actually used a body double to photograph some of the autopsy images that were later reported. They altered the X-rays. They patched the blood at the back of the head. But I have done massive evidence on the medical evidence in collaboration with a leading expert in the world today, David W. Mandick, MD, PhD. I published 3 books to which David was a major contributor. He's published a new book online on Amazon about the JFK head wounds. It is the definitive treatment, where I authored the introduction to the book. And I only wish that JFK were alive, but no, they succeeded in taking him out. There were multiple shooters. I appreciate your mention. Yes, Oswald was in the doorway, and therefore not only cannot have been the lone demanding gunman, but cannot have been one of the multiple shooters. We're going to take calls for Michelle after the break. 540-352-4452. 540-352-4452. Mitchell, bring in. Call with questions. This is a unique opportunity with an insider blowing the whistle big time.
Listen to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs, but there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
If you think for 1 second that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. But time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence. At the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming. And it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job? That Osama had nothing to do with it? That the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes? That Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building? Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons of the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and freedomslips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, this is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Raw Deal, with my featured guest, Michelle Stefanik, who is just a veritable goldmine of nuggets of information and personal knowledge of what did and did not happen in the State Department during the administration to Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. A lot of very nasty business. Michelle, I want to return to that question about what was the perception among you and your colleagues in the State Department in relation to 9/11. Were you taken in by the official account, or did it seem suspect to you from the beginning?
Well, Jim, you have to understand, when 9/11 happened, I was in Embassy Moscow, and literally it was our close of business, and I was walking home. I lived on the compound, so I was walking through the cafeteria, our compound, and there were all these people standing around the TV. And you have to understand, this is only 3 months after I was in New York to attend the Bin Laden trial. Well, we call it the Bin Laden trial, but now I don't. I call it the East Africa Embassy bombings. We all stayed at the World Trade Center Marriott. And I stood there and I watched as the first tower went down, as the second tower went down. And they literally said, Michelle, my face, when the second tower went down, literally the blood went down from my face that I went pale. And all I remember saying is, because of what we experienced in the embassy in Nairobi aftermath, I said, you have no idea the mass havoc that's going on right now on the ground, because they kept really focusing on the towers, right? You have to understand, I didn't have my aha moment about the embassy bombings until 2011, 2012. So I drank the Kool-Aid. I mean, I didn't focus in on it because I entrusted in the process. I entrusted in our institution. I entrusted in our intelligence community. I entrusted in our law enforcement. I entrusted in our military. I don't anymore. I trust myself. So did I drink the Kool-Aid, but it wasn't until I came back at my moment and then tossed everything that I had you know, knew out the window. And like I said, that's why I found it very odd that I would be continued giving breadcrumbs. Because initially I had my aha moment. It was very parochial. It dealt with just the embassy bombing. And then as I was getting more and more information, they're like, no, this is beyond. This is when you were with the State Department's IG. This is when you were with DCAA. You have, you know, trying to give me breadcrumbs to realize I have direct correlation to these events, but I didn't know it because I was just a federal auditor. I was a federal official. I was with the State Department's OIG. And then I had, the switch clicked. You know what I mean? I then looked back at everything with a whole different lens. Yes, but I can tell you, there were a lot of weird things going on. And I used to say, well, that's weird as shit. That's weird as shit. But I'm like, okay, I've never been through an experience like this. My biggest what in the world's going on did occur, but it was more internal politics. And I thought it was based on people's jealousy, people's trying to get ahead, being opportunist, trying to get awards, trying to get this, trying to get that. But when Ambassador Mary Ryan and I were scheduled to meet, and then all of a sudden, and this is whenever I was back from Sudan, I'd met with Mary Ryan, Ambassador Mary Ryan, who was politically taken out by Secretary Powell, which I'll never forgive him for. Because she was a good woman, and she stood and she went to battle of saying, you know, she went to battle because she knew a lot of things that people don't know to this day. And I met with her before I went on my tour to Khartoum, 2003 to 2005. And I met with her before I left, and I was going to meet with her after I got settled in Olympia Snow's office. And literally, we were in email exchange with each other to meet and have a one-on-one lunch. And we were in email correspondence to arrange the date, and then all of a sudden, she passed away. Well, it wasn't until after that I found out that she had gone down to nothing because she was eating nothing, basically, than saltine crackers. And then I'm thinking, oh, my God, someone made sure I didn't meet with Mary Ryan again. So do I have suspicion about Mary Ryan's passing? Absolutely. But, Jim, I can tell you this. She didn't issue the visas for those hijackers. State Department did not issue those visas for those supposed hijackers. Do you understand what I'm talking about?
Yeah, sure, but the hijackers were patsies. I mean, right. Half a dozen of them turned out alive and well the following
day. But who issued them the visas? That's why they took her out. They took her out because they blamed her for issuing the visas. Jim, State Department did not issue those visas.
Yes.
Where was John Brennan at that time?
Well,
State Department did not issue the visas.
Yes, yes, yes. I understood they were covertly or they were issued improperly. What agency did? Was it CIA arrange for their entry?
Based on my discussions with Mary Ryan, I would conclude that. So therefore, if they were being issued visas, who did they belong to?
Yes, well.
But it was not Mary Ryan that issued the visas. That I know. And I think they were very concerned that Mary Ryan had connected a lot of dots. And if Mary and I would have had that lunch when I was working with Senator Olympia Snow, who, by the way, was on the Intelligence Committee, that information would have got passed from me to Senator Olympia Snow, and they had to avoid it. So do I suspect something suspicious in her passing? I adored Mary Ryan. You have no idea the battles that she and I encountered together on some of the horrific stories regarding the treatment of my local staff and what our State Department did to particularly one of my employees that was the most severely injured. And it's not. It got so bad that one day Mary Ryan contacted me when I was at the Russian at FSI taking Russian language. She said, "Michelle, whatever you do, get your staffer a lawyer now." That implied to me, I never asked her any questions because of her position and her being a career, not a career Senate confirmed ambassador with a true ambassador title. Not someone that's, you know, selected for an ambassadorship here and there, but she was a career ambassador, Senate-confirmed ambassador. She told me to get this individual, one of my staffers, a lawyer, and I did. I got Arnold and Porter to take this individual's case on pro bono. When they found out that this individual's wife, who was being treated at Walter Reed. So this is happening in a military hospital. They were initially flown to Landstuhl, Germany, and then the most severely were brought over to Walter Reed. When I went to visit this individual for the first time in the aftermath of the bombing and me coming back from, Kenya, I walked in my first day with a colleague of mine. My FSN staff that almost died for a flag that wasn't his own was stripped down naked, wearing a diaper, handcuffed to the bed. This gentleman was blinded, suffered incredible brain trauma. I walked in, the other individual walked out. They could not even deal with it. I walked in. And this individual was talking in Kiswahili. And I went in and then said, you know, they used to call me Mama Safi, which means Mama Clean, because I cleaned up everything, they used to tease. And I walked in and I said to my staffer, I said, you have to speak, you're in the United States with Mama Safi. And my staffer looked up at my voice because he's blinded. He looked up at my voice and he, you know, calm down. And I said, you're here in the United States with Mama Safi. You have to speak English. Stop speaking, Kiswahili. And then I told the other individual to get a nurse to get these handcuffs off of him immediately. Well, what eventually happened is his wife came to join. His wife ended up became pregnant. I was at Russian language, and next thing you know, I have a message from the wife calling me saying, Mama, they're going to send me back to Nairobi today, tonight. And I'm like, what are you talking about? So I called Mary Ryan. Mary was on the phone with somebody else. Finally, she called me back, and I said, did you hear that they're whisking the wife back because she's pregnant? They didn't want her to have an American citizen child. So State Department was going to whisk her back to Kenya that night. Mary Ryan was in charge of consular affairs. So at one point in time, she was calling me, I was calling her, we were calling everybody in the State Department. We finally got connected, and Mary and I both threatened that we were both jointly going to go to the Washington Post if that didn't stop immediately. Later on that day, we were called. We were both calmed down. We were informed that the wife would not be returned to Kenya. And that individual, months later, had an American citizen child. But you have no idea the stuff that was going on behind the scenes. So that's why when the AUSA came down to see me in March or April of 2000, and asked me in my opinion on the sentencing of capital punishment, he was not ready for what I unloaded him with. And I do have a lot of more insight that he shared with me at that time. that there was massive concern about the delays, the frustrations they were having in getting evidential matter, evidence, truth, even in regards to our embassy bombing at the time that they were preparing for the East Africa embassy bombings trial. So did they have any instincts about 9/11? Potentially. I can tell you one of the AUSAs that was on our embassy bombing trial soon after went to work at the Pentagon with Sulek, I believe. No, maybe assistant for the Rumsfeld. Another one of the AUSAs went to Chicago and later was involved in the Valerie Flame case. Remember that?
Sure, of course.
So I can't speak on their behalf, but I have no doubt that they must have known. But I would offer you this. During the time I was retaliated against, Robert Mueller was FBI director. After Mary Jo White, as the U.S. attorney that tried the Bin Laden, the East Africa embassy bombings, James Comey was the Department of Justice, Southern District of New York, U.S. attorney. So why are all these names the same names? So, Jim, to answer your question, all I can speculate is somebody had to know something. Even my Supreme Court case filings. Do you know what the response was for my filings? There was a response that basically, and I'm not a lawyer, but it's documented, the Solicitor General for the Department of Justice filed the response, what's called a waiver response, to my filings in the U.S. Supreme Court. And it basically, I'm paraphrasing as a layperson not being a lawyer, it basically said, the Department of Justice is not going to provide a response unless the court, the Supreme Court, makes us file one. So, Mary Jo White was made aware of what was happening to me. At any point in time, she could have gone to the Supreme Court and said she has standing and she wants to know if everything happened to me because of being a witness to her case. She had standing. She had a right to know. President Trump, is my understanding, someone in his administration was aware. Someone could have made the Supreme Court make the Department of Justice file a response to prove that the retaliatory actions taken against me were political because of what I knew. But because they knew that I also had this protected status, not only as a federal auditor, a federal official, but as a Crime Victims' Rights Act protected victim and witness, it was too close for them, so they had to destroy my credibility instead. Now, I have a couple more insights to provide.
You go right ahead, then I'll have further questions. Go right ahead.
Okay. Do you know who the chief of station was in Embassy Nairobi at the time of the bombings?
I do not.
Do you know who the deputy CIA chief was when Gina Haspel resigned?
No. You tell me.
Vaughn Bishop.
I should know the name, but I don't.
But my point is, Vaughn Bishop was the chief of station at Embassy Nairobi at the time of the embassy bombings. Vaughn Bishop was the deputy CIA director under Gina Haspel, under the tenure of Special Forces Green Beret Christopher Miller. Cash Patel was supposed to be moved over to the CIA. Well, Cash Patel was in the House. I think he was a House Armed Services staffer or Intel staffer at the time of November 27, 2012 whistleblower protection request letter. So not only did I give it to Senator Olympia Snow, since Senator Snow was resigning, she asked me, what do we do next? Who do you want me to give it to? Who do you want me to entrust it in? And Jim, I will be totally honest with you. I did not look at the politics of it. I had contacted not only people in the President Barack Obama's White House to make sure the Dems were aware, as much as the Repubs, because this was not political. This was a matter of our national security, and the threat against our government and our nation were real. So after Senator Olympia Snowe, she said, who do you want me to share this with? And I said, Mike Rogers, Chairman Mike Rogers. The reason why is because Mike Rogers not only was U.S. Army, former U.S. Army, he was also former FBI, and he was the current chairman of the HPSI. And so the chief of staff for Senator Olympia Snowe, I gave them another copy of an 8-page handwritten whistleblower protection request packet. That chief of staff for Olympia Snowe gave it to the chief of staff of Mike Rogers. That individual blocked Chairman Rogers from even knowing that he got it. And that individual, that chief of staff, worked at the State Department prior, worked in the Bush administration. At the same time, is my understanding, also, Roger Zackheim, and Scott Bennett will appreciate that name, Roger Zackheim was in the House Armed Services Committee. So that's why I still have a question. Who was the source? Because Rumsfeld didn't know about the $2.3 trillion. Somebody told him about that. Who told him that number? Who told him, who was his source for the $2.3 trillion? Was the source aware that it was $2.3 trillion of over $14.6 trillion? Or did that source only know it was $2.3 trillion? Because if they knew it was a larger number and the son was in the House Armed Services Committee when I asked for my Crime Victims' Rights Act protected status accordingly, that individual obstructed justice because they wanted to make sure nobody knew about the higher number. Well, once I heard the higher number, the timeline of events, and because I was on the state OIG team that discovered the way funds were being diverted, we just didn't know how much it was, and we didn't know whose funds they were. Because people also have to understand, we were of the first State Department Office of Inspector General, the statutorily independent IG Sherman Funk. Before that, the State Department's IG was Foreign Service inspecting Foreign Service. I was one of the first ones brought in under the new statutorily independent Sherman Funk, who was civil servant. So you have no idea what we were uncovering and discovering at that time.
Well, Dov Zakheim, of course, was not only a dual U.S.-Israeli citizen, but even a rabbi. He had a company with remote control for aircraft to take over aircraft in the circumstance of a hijacking, but would enable the aircraft to be remotely controlled. I believe that was the original plan for 9/11, to use remotely controlled aircraft to attack the Twin Towers, but it turned out it was physically impossible to get the planes all the way into the building because of their robust design, and therefore they had to fake it. That's a long story. We don't need to pursue here and now, which everyone who regularly listens to this show knows can be found laid out in spades on 9/11, who was responsible and why on BitChute, 9/11, who was responsible and why. But, you know, it seems to me pretty obvious where a whole lot of that money went, which was not America first. but rather our alleged gallant ally in the Middle East. You know, I'd be fascinated if you were able to comment on Israel's influence over U.S. foreign policy.
Well, what I would like to give you is a little bit more insight about because of knowing what I know, I instantly knew of the entity that potentially was involved. And I have shared my insight accordingly with, it's my understanding, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, as well as the U.S. Navy Seabees, have independently verified and confirmed the entity that I have my theory of, because of the interconnections of what I know, had the capability to do a controlled demolition. That being said, I want to give you a few minutes insight on the World Trade Center 7.
Wonderful, now, I know, but Susan, you need to hold that thought. We have another break coming up. Anyone who'd like to call and speak to Michelle Stefanik, a wonderful source, 540-352-4452 is the call-in number, 540-352-4452. Mitchell, field your call and get you on the air with me and Michelle. Stand by. We'll be right back.
Like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Revolution Radio, every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, on Studio B for Momentary Zen, with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job, that Osama had nothing to do with it? that the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes. That Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building. Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons of the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Raw Deal, where I have the great pleasure of featuring Michelle Stefanik about her vast experience in the Department of State. She has really proven to be not only a formidable intellect, but a vast resource of information about developments during both the Clinton and the Obama administration. Michelle, you were wanting to share some reflections about 9/11. Please proceed.
Well, regarding the World Trade Center 7, I think a lot of people, I realize there's a lot of, you know, speculation as to why World Trade Center 7. And I just want to offer this because of the continuum of the facts that I know. As I already told you, I was flown back with the Department of Justice, Southern District of New York, to attend the East African Embassy bombings in June of 2001. We all stayed at World Trade Center Marriott. Now, did I ever connect about 9/11? No, but I can assure you that there were a lot of Kenyans that did. A lot of those, they were really scared. They really did connect our embassy bombing to 9/11, you know, and really thought that we were the cause of it because we all stayed at the World Trade Center Marriott. But I want to give some insight about World Trade Center 7. A lot of people may or may not know, it's my understanding, the Department of Justice, now do you remember the Enron WorldCom litigation?
Sure, and all the records were there in Building 7. You're absolutely right, as well as
and they were totally destroyed.
Yes.
Now, you don't find it odd that when Robert Mueller was special counsel, he had people that were involved in Lockerbie, people that were involved in Watergate, people that were involved in Enron, WorldCom. See, so they have to openly admit this is one huge, long continuum. So I would offer to you, though it is not fancy, World Trade Center 7 went down because of all the working documents they had to try WorldCom Enron, because, of course, those two entities supposedly were CIA fronts. Arthur Anderson, an auditor, coincidentally just like me, you know, anybody that knows the profession of auditing, you know, you pull one string, it doesn't go anywhere. You pull another string, it doesn't go anywhere. If you pull the right string, the whole entire sweater collapses. And that's why I believe, because of knowing what I know and having a linkage to all these events that I had no idea was going on all around me, because I wasn't intelligence, I wasn't law enforcement, I wasn't military, I was just State Department, Foreign Service, you know? But I want to give a little bit more insight about these events because a lot of people don't know this. I was, when I was in Kenya, I was regional for our embassy in the Seychelles, as well as our embassy in Sudan. Now, there is so much I can provide on our embassy in Sudan and the whole, you know, Susan Rice, Tim Carney, Ambassador Tim Carney, the Sudanese wanting to give us bin Laden and Ambassador Carney trying to get them to do that, you know, in parallel to, like, General Hamm trying to go back and say, hey, you know, Gaddafi wants us to help, you know, and him being squashed. It's the same type of scenario, right? Ambassador Carney said that the Sudanese government approached them. This was like a 1993, 94 time frame. There's a whole Vanity Fair article about this. Susan Rice refused. So years later, now all of a sudden, you know, bin Laden did all this. But anyways, I was regional for Sudan at that time. Soon after, Tim Carney tried to get the U.S. government to take bin Laden at that time. They refused. Soon after, Tim left, he was shut down. Our embassy was shut down, and basically he had to do a shuttle diplomacy out of Embassy Nairobi. I was regional for Sudan at that time. Fortunately, whenever the August 20 retaliatory strike, which was also the exact same day that I departed, which I have lots of insight about that, our embassy staff were not, nobody was killed. There were people that were still up there, our local staff that were injured. No one was killed. But in 2003, 2005, they were talking about normalizing operations, no longer working out of Kenya, but actually operating out off the ground again in Sudan. So I accepted a position to become the first management officer to live in Khartoum in 2003 to 2005. When I was there, oddly enough, you would think if it was really dangerous, we would have Marine security guards. We didn't. When I was there, I was staying in an apartment complex that had some working offices out of the same apartment complex I was living. And in the middle of the night, I got a bang on my door, basically whisking me out in the middle of the night because supposedly our apartment complex where I was staying ended up on the Al-Qaeda website. That is because there was no MSGs, no Marine security guards. Now, at that time, I don't know if it's still going on now, the Marine security guards do not report to the Commandant of the Marine Corps, do not report to the highest-ranking military official out of embassy. They work directly for diplomatic security. So when diplomatic post Benghazi was attacked, one of the pivotal parallels that I had was, again, there was no Marine security guards at diplomatic post Benghazi. I find that very curious, and that's why the parallels are so stark. And my thought was this. Later on, I found out that there was a huge lawsuit blaming Sudan on our embassy bombings. I was never asked to be part of that lawsuit. I was never asked for my insight. Ambassador Tim Carney supposedly testified, as did an FBI agent, and supposedly they were told the federal judge, I think in the District of Columbia, refused to accept them as evidential matter, you know, that their information was pertinent. So I contacted the ambassador to Sudan to say, make sure he was aware, because at this point in time, I've had enough of this nonsense that was going on. I mean, we're talking people died here. You know, this isn't a joke. So I contacted him, and I introduced myself via an interlocutor and said, I just want to let you know that I was assigned to Khartoum from 2003 to 2005. I helped purchase the land of which we now have a new embassy there. And he was delighted to talk to me. But I said, sir, you have to also understand, are you aware that I'm a victim and a witness in regards to the August 7, 1998 East Africa Embassy bombings in Kenya? And he goes, no, I was not aware. I said, so if Sudan was so dangerous that you're being blamed in a federal lawsuit that I was never contacted about in regards to, how come it was so unsafe? Then why did they elect me to be signed there in 2003 to 2005 with no Marine security guards? None of this makes any sense. So my question is this. I think a way forward at this point in time is the Supreme Court, not only in my case, has shown how blatantly questionable what's going on, but now it's become very, very important regarding election fraud. And I must say, do I believe that there was election fraud? I don't have access to the evidence. But as a professional federal auditor, you better believe anytime you have a human being involved, you have a potential for fraud. And I also believe when you're an elected official, you may have to come up as a Republican or Democrat, but by golly, once you raise your hand to take an oath to defend the Constitution, you represent all your people of your constituency, Democrats and Republicans alike. That's what makes the difference between being a candidate and a federal elected official. Therefore, I would also offer to you, I have contacted the Department of Justice and the FBI and even DOD, because if it is a federal crime, a federal felony offense to threaten, intimidate, harass, or mislead a witness, in this situation, me, in a criminal or civil proceeding, many people that are now in office, and I'm talking two branches of our government, and both parties committed federal felonies and therefore were ineligible to have even run for federal elected office to begin with. So I do believe a way forward, it's time for military tribunals. Arrests have to be made in both parties, all three branches of government, and sworn affidavits have to be taken at minimum from individuals like myself, like Scott Bennett, like Christopher Fulton, because we're not researchers. We're firsthand victims and witnesses that were massively retaliated against. And this nonsense has to come to an end because no one is above the law. And I can assure you, at this point in time, this is now 2021. Well, comparison, let's see, 28 of the 100 members in our U.S. Senate at this point in time, 28 of the 542 members of the second co-equal branch of government, 28% were in office on August 7, 1998. 48 of the 442 members of Congress, 10.86%, were there in their office at the time of August 7, 1998. 76 members, current members of our U.S. Congress, of the 542, were members, were 14.2%, were there in August 7, 1998. And I can assure you, I contacted all of them, and none of them protected me, none of them. The only member of Congress that did anything to get to the bottom of all this was Senator Olympia Snowe. Whenever I gave the information to this chief of staff for the HPC chairman, Rogers, he had the package for a couple days. I finally, and I was advised by Senator Snowe's chief of staff, I finally called the chief of staff's member directly and the personal staff of Chairman Rogers to ask them if they're aware of my package that came over from Senator Olympia Snow. That individual, okay, was so rude, and I went ballistic because of his unprofessional, unethical comments, not only about me, but Senator Olympia Snow, who was still in office, the representative of our fellow Americans that live in the state of Maine. He was so rude that, and he did nothing with my package. You know what he did? He called Capitol Police, Captain Zimmerman, to call him, to call me, to say that I was threatening Chairman Rogers' chief of staff. This was also during the time when we had, remember, we were going over the cliff, and they called back all the House, Speaker Boehner called back the House to do the vote. So through Chairman Royce's staffer, I got a message to Chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Royce, to ask member to member on the floor directly, Chairman Rogers, if Chairman Rogers was aware of the packet, the whistleblower protection request package that came over from Senator Olympia Snow. He said he was never aware of it. Now, why did I go to Chairman Rogers? Because it is an open secret how many people in the State Department are really not State Department. So, Jim Fetzer, who has jurisdiction when nobody in the House or the Congress, intelligence, HVAC, the Foreign Affairs, or Armed Services, or Judiciary have oversight for those that are embedded in other organizations? That is what Trey Gowdy brought to light under the Accountability Review Board with Benghazi when 75-plus victims and witnesses were not interviewed by Ambassador Tom Pickering and Admiral Mike Mullen. And by the way, I was never interviewed in the applicable Accountability Review Board for our embassy in Nairobi. I was the FMC director over money, and I was never interviewed. I had contacted every step of the way, NCIS, ACIS, DOJ, FBI, diplomatic security, special forces, you name it. Congress, I contacted everybody, and that is why I documented it in my Supreme Court case filings for historic record. What is going on, Jim? This has to stop. This war in the dark at the expense of the American people has to stop.
Well, Michelle, what you have to report is so important, even devastating in its ramifications and implications. I've been fascinated how some of those in Congress, like Trey Gowdy and Jason Chaffetz and others, wind up being pushed out. I'm just astonished. So that from playing a key role in Congress, they wind up serving as commentators, which is beneficial to the public, but not in the direct role they were able to play when they were members of Congress.
They pushed them out because they would have connected their own dots.
Yes. 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 Listen, I want to take advantage of a few minutes that remain for your assessment of what's going on with this Biden-Harris administration. It appears to be totally fraudulent. They're using what appear to be all kinds of Hollywood special effects. Even the inauguration was pre-recorded. I mean, it's just stunning. Any reflections you have about the state of affairs in Washington, D.C. today would be most welcome.
Yes, and this is not a political statement. This is a statement of fact. It is and was a federal felony offense to threaten, intimidate, harass, or mislead a witness, me, in a criminal and civil proceeding. These members of Congress that are now elected officials were in office at the time of the August 7, 1998 East Africa embassy bombings. They passed the Crime Victims' Rights Act, protected victim and witness the law. They committed federal felonies, as far as I'm concerned, and therefore were ineligible to have even run for federal office to begin with because they committed a federal felony offense. They need to be removed immediately. I had contacted the Department of Justice. I had contacted the FBI. I had contacted DOD because UCMJ also applies that all these people and these individuals need to be removed immediately because, in the words of Speaker Pelosi, no one is above the law. But they all knew. They all knew. And at any point in time, they could have put an end to all this, and they didn't. Therefore, they need to be removed from office because they put party and self above our American people, as far as I'm concerned. And there is no statute of limitation for murder. There's no statute of limitation for treason. And I would offer there's also no statute of limitation for certain fraud, especially when the fraud is discovered. I believe there are very, very guilty individuals, both parties and all three branches of government, to include, I would offer, like I said from the very beginning, officers and employees of the Department of Justice and other department and agencies of the United States engaged in detection, investigation, or prosecution of crime shall make their best efforts to see that crime victims are notified and accorded the rights described. That includes every single member of every single intelligence agency, every single member of the military, every single member of law enforcement up and down the chain, from the federal government to the local sheriff. That includes everybody. Because I, over and over and over and over again, throughout my circumstances, advised immediately and accordingly that I was being retaliated against because of my protected status, according, you know, under the Crime Victims' Rights Act. So they violated the Crime Victims' Rights Act, and they violated a federal, they committed a federal felony and harassment and threatening me and retaliating against me. And I do have standing.
Yes,
because as far as I'm concerned, the true perpetrators of our embassy bombing still have not been caught. And that case needs to be reopened.
Michelle, in the last few minutes, anything you'd like to say to the audience general, where they can find more about your work, your experience, your life story? It's been absolutely fascinating.
Well, at this point in time, I'm kind of leery. I have written a manuscript. When it's going to be published, I have no idea 100% for sure, but I can give you this. As I wrote my book and my manuscript, I sent it to former Army Special Forces, former Navy SEALs, as well as some of my colleagues from the U.S. Army War College. The evidence and the documentation is written in such a way that they could verify and confirm every step of the way. Before I signed under contract with a publisher, I have registered the unedited, unpublished book with the Library of Congress, the Patent Office, because I knew once I went under contract that the publisher had, rights to make edits accordingly. I have done the first set of edits, cutting it down from over 700 pages to 400 pages. We are now in the process of doing a third kind of edits. I don't know the timeline of events at this point in time, but at this point in time, the book's title is going to be Tell the Truth Until They Don't Like What You Have to Say, Memoir of a Department of State Oath-Taking Survivor. And I was going to establish a website, but only when the book was published. I do have an email address if people want to contact me. It's kind of long, but I want it to be a reminder every time they send something to me. And it's one word, oathtakingtruthteller@gmail.com. Again, oathtakingtruthteller@gmail.com. Jim, this is really real, and this stuff has to come to an end. Do I have theories of way forward? I have a professional auditor background, so I have a boatload of recommendations based on what I have seen so that this never, ever, ever happens again. I don't know if Christopher Miller was unaware, but I really do believe the Special Forces and the Marines, have some real adjustments that they need to do, because they're our tip of the spear, and that tip of the spear is not just for foreign enemies, but it's also for domestic enemies, and they take an oath just as you and I did, not to a president, not to a person, but to our Constitution. And they now are witness and bear witness to the corruption of within our three co-equal branches of government.
Michelle, I cannot thank you enough for joining me today. Everyone here has had the opportunity of hearing a first-rate mind discuss very important matters. Michelle, you were just a fabulous guest. I cannot thank you enough.
Well, thank you, Jim.
Listening to Revolution Radio.
Como va? This is Giuseppe from the District of Criminals. I pulled some strings and gotten you front row seats to my new show, The Perfect Triangle. Live Friday, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Revolution Radio Studio A. The Perfect Triangle is equilateral, three sides of the same length. In an angry, bipolar world, three perfect sides reveal many truths.
Body, mind, and spirit.
Thought, word, and deed.
Conspiracy, propaganda, and truth.
Natural health, allopathic tyranny, and your body.
Freedom, globalism, and sovereign nations.
And so much more. Each week, the Perfect Triangle will blast through fake news lies, champion the natural way and natural law, unravel the Orwellian deceptions of our corrupt government, reveal the satanic evil of globalist banks and transnational corporations. Tune in every Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern, to Revolution Radio Studio A for thoughtful discussions with free thinkers. Your calls are always welcome. The Perfect Triangle, with Giuseppe from the District of Criminals. Join me, won't you?
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We did not... In-